Well, that was a great event. Thanks, Steve. It's really exciting to see so many faces here, particularly seeing those who haven't been to an Issues and Ale before. I think it's because we're all feeling so calm and good about how things are right now. We just want to get together and sing Kumbaya and just, you know, be so happy about things. So here's how things are going to work. If we don't start questions right away, the five of us will continue to talk about the importance of journalism and things like that. So we really want you to stand up early on and ask your questions. We may not be able to answer them, but at least let's have you have the conversations. Bob still has Rick's mic off. That's amazing. I'll keep telling you when to turn it off and on. So I want to introduce the folks who are here on stage with us. We have Lee Wilkins, who runs the journalism department at Wayne State University.
Not quite.
Well, might as well. The chair has written a lot on the ethics of journalism. So questions about whether or not journalists should be objective in a time like this, and how we cover the stories that we're covering right now. We will turn to Lee for those answers. Chad Livengood, to my left, right here, physically speaking, not politically necessarily, is a reporter at Crain's Detroit Business. Chad recently joined Crain's from the Detroit News, so we're going to talk a little bit with Chad about what it's like to go from one of the big Detroit papers to Crain's, which is doing some pretty incredible things right now in the city and reporting on stories that maybe the two biggies, the Freep and the News, wouldn't. Chad also was the one to break the Corser Gamrat scandal, so you can thank him for the hours and hours of coverage on that one. To my far right, again, physically speaking, is Chastity Pratt. Chastity writes for Bridge Magazine, and if you all haven't read Bridge Magazine, yes. Chastity has a piece last week, 2 weeks ago, about Legionnaires' disease in Flint. And if you want to see what journalism should be and what it can be in Michigan, please read that article. It is what true investigative journalism is all about. So if you haven't, bridgemi.org? .com is the place to find it, and please do, because it's pretty amazing. And to my right, last but certainly not least, Rick Pluta, my co-host of It's Just Politics. Rick, we brought you here tonight because you have been a journalist in Michigan for, what, 30 years now?
About 35.
Yeah. Okay, so for 35 years. To talk
30
to
years
us about
the Capitol,
but how things are changing in journalism today. I am Jack Lessenberry this evening because we are all about alternative facts. So that's how I'm gonna come under. Let's just talk a little bit. One word, lightning round. As silly as sometimes I think this is, Chastity, I want to start with you, and let's move this way. The state of journalism, whether we're talking nationally, whether we're talking statewide, what is the one word that comes to you right now to describe it? Epic eye roll.
Blurry.
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 Rick Pluta.
Amazing.
Someone cut him off. Lee.
Dynamic.
Dynamic.
In flux.
Okay. Lee, let's start with you. Why?
We've lost part of our business model. Lots of new things are being invented, like Bridge, like what Crain's is doing. At the same time, there's huge opportunity out there. I think I tell our students all the time that journalism is going to be reinvented in this century, and it's going to be reinvented in our cities. So here we are in Detroit. We have this great opportunity to do it. It's a great time to be a journalist if you especially have a little bit of oomph and a little bit of drive and a whole lot of fortitude.
Chad?
I agree with all that. I think it's in flux because our traditional legacy mediums are struggling because they have not yet adapted to the new era of digital journalism, and they don't have the revenue sources that they don't have a diversified revenue source. They're relying on people to buy a subscription, buy it off the newsstand, or have a advertisement in, and those advertisers are starting to shrink. I mean, I just use the example Macy's is closing some 30, 40 stores around the country, and a couple of them are in Michigan.
Can I still get Ivanka products, though, from those places?
No, that's a little below Ivanka, I believe. So, that's an example. I mean, if you look inside any daily metropolitan newspaper, one of the biggest advertisers is Macy's. And as those advertisers shrink, that's another revenue source is going to shrink. So I think that's still to be determined what happens in our traditional metropolitan news outlets.
Okay, Rick, amazing. Why?
Because there's more interest and demand for what we do than I think ever before. Yet at the same time, the business model is being reinvented, as Chad pointed out. How we do our jobs is being reinvented, just on every platform. Not just that we have to be visual and audio focused at the same time that we're writing and putting up all kinds of links and all of that, but we have to reinvent what we're doing at the same time that we're reaffirming our commitment to the basic values of what we're doing. And so I've just never been more excited about doing the job that we do than I have right now.
Blurry. Detroit hat. What's your name? John. John, by midnight, can be a journalist. All he needs is a .com, a podcast. I mean, really, it's really blurry. Who is a journalist nowadays? A journalist? Do you have to work at a .com? Do you have to work at a newspaper or a radio station? Anybody can be a journalist. Just throw some stuff up on the internet, say it's real, and you call yourself a journalist.
I mean, although anyone always could. That's been true since the birth of our
internet.
Republic and before. That it used to be there was, whether or not you were a respected or recognized journalist, had to do whether or not you could get entree to someone who owned a printing press and then a radio or a TV tower. And now it's a lot that entree is a lot easier. But for a long time it was possible for someone to
do a...
It does. It does. And in some respects, it's changed, but it's also not changed. I think that reputation matters more than ever.
And I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because anybody can throw stuff up on the web. That's true. But to call yourself a journalist, you really have to decide who you're going to be loyal to. Journalists are loyal to citizens. Journalists are loyal to democracy. Journalists are loyal to government.
That's how we look at it. Consumers of content don't know the difference.
Here indicated that there are some consumers of content who do know the difference, and maybe part of our new job, my job certainly as a teacher, is to teach the folks who don't know how to see the difference, because it is perceptible.
But I think that's Lee's point, there's a difference
between purveyors of content and people who are journalists.
So just a second, let's take a temperature check. Hands, for those when you think of journalists, let's say that there is warm fuzzies, right? You're thinking trustworthy, you're thinking people you count on. Raise your hands. Okay. Yeah, I'm talking like real journalists.
Keep your hands raised if you put journalists in the same category as lawyers.
But what I'm saying is there are so many new media out there. So many. Everybody has a podcast. Everyone has, a blog. And why wouldn't the consumer believe that these internet journalists are journalists? Now, whether or not you put them on the level of a Chad Livengood, that's different. But they
don't feed the ego anymore. that needs to happen.
But the variety is there, and people. I mean, come on, my son thinks that World Star Hip Hop is news. I mean, why not? So
well, in a way,
is it up to then the consumer in 2017 to decide whether what they're reading is journalism? Has that switched, though? And I want to hear from everyone.
It's blurry. When you open the paper or you go to the big paper's site and you see sponsored content, it looks exactly like a news story. How do you know that was written by the marketing department at Health Alliance Plan, or as opposed to the business department at newspaper.com, that's where it gets blurry.
We're getting blurry. Here's an example. In small town newspapers, increasingly, They're just running press releases. On the front page of the Mount Pleasant Morning Sun, the daily newspaper for the town of the Central Michigan University, they are running stories bylined by the CMU Journalism Public Relations Department. Photos as well, packaged in like, I mean, that'll be like the, you know, the main spread in front of the front page, and taking up some serious real estate. Written by, are they journalists?
Yeah. Well, although, just but on that point in particular, though, that if you went the really old-fashioned, up the newspaper chain, that you started out at a weekly newspaper where that was probably the norm, that your congressmen and local businesses and whatever set in press releases that you then set in type and printed as part of your news product alongside bylined stories by your one or two reporters who's probably also the editor.
Some of this is actual, like, what we would consider like government watchdog news. I mean, I saw one story recently was about the city council approving like an economic development zone in the city of Mount Pleasant for the Central Michigan University, written by Central Michigan University, based on Central Michigan University's interpretation of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is patently offensive that newspapers are giving up at this
point. We can go down this rabbit hole, which I want to, but I want to get back to Lee quickly, and then I want to open it up to questions, because as I did predict, we will just continue to talk unless we take some questions. But Lee, is it up to the consumer to decide to figure out whether it's real or fake news?
I think it's always been up to the consumer to decide that. I mean, one reason that you know it's a certain kind of content is because legitimate news organizations label it as a certain kind of content. In journalism school, we teach people don't print the press release. There are, however, a lot of studies out there that say that news journalists couldn't get along without PR folks, because if you look at our news content, more than half of it begins, doesn't end, but begins with a public relations release.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
No. That's a bad reporter.
No. Well,
never.
But it's also a reality.
I think that is because of the shortage of journalists. Now, there's two things that happened in the 22 years that I've been a journalist. Number one, everybody has a
spokesperson. Chastity started when she was 8 years old, by the way.
Everyone has a PR person. There used to be, you would get to a crime scene and talk to the cop. What happened? Now it's, we have a spokesperson for that. Mm-hmm. And it used to be you go to the cop shop and look through all the reports, what happened last night. There's a spokesperson for that now. But also, everyone has a PR person. What the hell? When did that happen? It just like happened like 10 years ago. It hasn't always been that way.
But it hasn't.
It hasn't, although I've also made this point. Sometimes I'm on panels and I hear PR people say, well, you know, that it's symbiotic, that you couldn't do your job without us and you wouldn't exist without us and vice versa. It's like, no, actually, you know, a good PR person can be very valuable to a journalist doing their job, but we would be doing our job, hopefully at least, whether or not the PR person in the public relations profession existed. Although if the public relations profession didn't exist, someone would invent it.
I would be happy.
Okay, let's open it up to some questions. So, Lindsay here, how about raise your hands if you've got questions, and let's not act like there aren't any questions out there, because we've all got them, including all of us. If you'll at least just say your first name and how about where you're from, and we've got someone right here in the middle, Lindsay. This young woman.
So my name's Elizabeth.
Hi, Elizabeth.
I'm just Metro Detroit. I'm a teacher, and I teach ninth grade civics. And this election has been very interesting because I have my students coming forward and saying so many things that I think, you know, that's probably not honest journalism.
Yeah. Can you give us an example?
So there was a lot with the Muslim ban.
Okay.
Obviously, the travel ban.
Yeah.
And just recently, today, there was talk again about these students, and not just from the news, but also with their peers and sort of other organizations, talking about, just general U.S. foreign affairs. And so with Lee's comment about teaching journalism and how to look out for, you know, consumers of news, what can I do as an educator to make sure that my students can tell the difference between that fake news and that, you know, Honest news.
I was going to say, same thing that I do, which is to teach them that they don't just get it all from one source, yeah. And news doesn't come to you on your Facebook page. Yeah, I know. It's tough. But it's the same thing. It's the same thing we teach college students, because actually they're in the same place that your ninth graders are. To tell a college student or some adults that if you read something in the New York Times, it would be good to go check it out with other sources. If you read something on a blog, it would be good to go check it out with other sources. One of the great things about the internet is that we can all do that. We are all kludgy enough researchers that we can put in a couple of search terms in Google or whatever your preferred search engine is, and we can go out and see, you know, what's the range of opinion going there.
But isn't the issue that people aren't doing that due diligence?
I think people aren't doing that due diligence all the time. I think one of the potentially interesting effects of the 2016 election is going to be your people are sort of rediscovering how necessary it is. I think the other thing that may happen is that some of us, probably some of us up here, could tell you, my trusted sources about these topics tend to be. And if you go and you check enough, I think you will discover that you trust what you read in Cranes. You trust what you see on Bridge. You trust what you read in the Freep, or you don't. But it's a matter of learning to judge and learning to look at what is legitimate information. And it's hard, but it's something that I think we all have to do. And not just in ninth grade. I think actually for this generation of kids, we need to start when they're in elementary school. It's actually got a word. It's called news literacy. And we try to teach it in many, many ways.
But isn't the concern that for the folks in this room tonight, that that's not the conversation we need to be having, that it's people who want to be in some sort of bubble, right? That it's the confirmation bias, that you want to believe the things that you want to, and that we've gotten to be in a society where you just get your news from Facebook and your friends tend to be of the same, let's say, you know, social, economic platforms that you are. You read something, you want to believe it. Why would you double check? And that we're becoming more insular in the way that we read news. And isn't that the issue? Yeah.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of something that I was talking to a government official who was trying to sell a bridge in Detroit. And...
with a swamp?
No, across a river. And
to a foreign land?
To a foreign land.
South of us?
Yes. He said one of the things that they were running into was that every fact, you know, quote unquote, was being litigated. And they said that there used to be a time, you know, in Metro Detroit, at least, I'm going to try to remember the names, that he said that it used to be back in the day that when J.P. McCarthy at WJR, Bob Giles at the Detroit News, and Joe Stroud at the Free Press said that something was a fact, it was a fact. And now every fact is litigated, that people are allowed to pick and choose their facts. And we don't have the same consensus around fact gathering that we used to. And you know, the three people that I just mentioned were also, you know, not just renowned Detroit, you know, media personalities, but they were opinionators. They didn't always come from the same place, but, you know, that they delivered opinions, but there wasn't agreement on facts.
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that we're having a little bit of trouble distinguishing fact from opinion. Journalism is a profession of verification. That's what we do. We say, this is what I know, and this is how I know it, so that your reader, your viewer, your listener can go check it out for themselves. That's, in my view, very different from formulating an opinion based on fact. And I think we've lost some of that distinction. And certainly we lose it all the time on Facebook and in a lot of blogs. But when you're doing journalism, you're putting facts out there, but you're showing your readers, your viewers, your listeners, this is where I got that fact. This is why I think that is a fact. Or this is that fact in a context. That's what journalism does. And I don't think we have abandoned that, nor do I think we should. And it's part of, to get back to Elizabeth's question, it's part of news literacy. Part of what you should be asking with everything you read or listen to, as well as us up here, is how do they know that? Can they tell me why it is that they think that they know that?
And that goes back to the point of fake news. If you can't verify it, You know, just because you say something over and over again doesn't mean that it's true.
And saying so-and-so said it's a fact doesn't make it true either.
It may be
literally factually true that they said it, but that does not make it factually true.
Absolutely. I covered schools for the Free Press for 12 years, and I would write the same story sometimes or write the same fact, and I would still have to cite the source, even though I wrote the same thing 20 times before. You have to say where it came from. Otherwise, it can be construed as unverified, therefore subject to being fake.
Chad?
Well, I was going to get to a point here about people, about credibility of journalists, and I really strive on subject matter, that I dive into the subject and try to learn about it from all different angles. Today, I took a ferry boat ride across the Detroit River for reasons I won't divulge here, because I'm working on a story and trying to understand something extensively from top to bottom in ways that the average person on Facebook would never do nor take time to do, and ways a lot of other journalists don't have time to do. But one thing I just sort of noticed about way people interpret facts is also sometimes well beyond our control. I wrote a column for Cranes yesterday that looked at Betsy DeVos and how her ascension to the to U.S. Education Secretary could be an opening here to reignite the discussion in Detroit about having a commission be in control of where schools get opened and closed. And one of Betsy DeVos's political operatives today, I'm not going to go there.
That's unbearable.
One of her political operatives posted it on Twitter and totally attributed something to me that I did not say in the column at all. And I'll be frank, I was a little bit busy and I just didn't feel like engaging him in a back and forth on Twitter. I could have spent all day on this.
He would have loved it.
But I just decided not to. I said, you know what? Fine. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate the link to my column. I'll let people read it and conclude themselves and see how it goes.
Okay, let's open it up to some more questions. Let's see. Over here, this young woman in the hoodie, gray hoodie. Yep. You.
All right, hi, I'm Amelia. I'm also from Metro Detroit.
Hi, Amelia.
Hi. How do you engage with more conservative family members who often take criticism as a sign of bias in news?
Did you say family members?
Yes. Yeah, so...
Well, I don't care if strangers on the street tell me that because New York Times is critical that it's biased and left-leaning, but with dinner with my grandmother, I can't really just say, shut up. I can, but I can't say it like that.
So instead of talking about it, whether, let's say, how any of us would, because I think the idea then posits it that somehow we have to, that we're liberals and we're arguing against conservatives. But help me understand then, Chastity, if you are having a debate about, you know, you are critical right now of Michael Flynn for a possibility that he did before Trump became president, you know, talk about Russian sanctions, and you are just giving the facts, and someone says, well, just the fact that you are doing that story makes you biased.
My response to that, I mean, again, covering Detroit schools for 15 years, people have accused me of being biased in favor of the district, biased against the district, biased in favor of the state, biased against the state, and my response is always, but did I lie? Is it true? Is the information that I shared verified in the story? Is it true? What's the difference? What does it matter whether it was something you found to be too sad or too mean or too whatever? If it's true, it's true. That's my job, just to put the facts out there.
I think that there is a couple of things. The way that you may be using the word bias with your grandma is really interesting, because you're talking about political bias. So I'm going to say that there's more than one kind of bias. For example, I think that this is the first panel that there have been more women on than there are men. Is that biased? As a member of the female persuasion, okay, I would argue that a lot of journalism.
Were you persuaded to be female?
Yes. There is my husband. Ask. That I would argue that there's a lot of very subtle biases that aren't political biases, but it's bias. That's not because journalists set out to be evil, okay? It's because we live in a culture, and the culture itself is not neutral about some of these things. What I would amplify what Chastity said, because I'm like right on, is the way that you know that a journalist is not biased is, did you go out and get a hold of every fact you could, even the ones you didn't like? And if you confirm that they were a fact and they were true, does that wind up in your story? That's a way of being unbiased in the sense that you have gone to collect all the facts, not just ones that your editor agree with or that your family agree with or that your grandma might be comfortable with.
Right, I think one of the things that makes a journalist a journalist is that we recognize that there aren't two sides, like you just said, that it's not just Republicans and Democrats, but that there are often many sides, and that storytelling is a process, that it's not just one story and done, that very often it's many, 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 many stories, like 15 years of covering the Detroit public schools, and that our job is to seek out a variety of perspectives, fold as many of them into our stories as we can, or any given stories we can, and then move on to the next one. But it's not just binary and that there's one or the other. And hopefully in the process of doing that, even if we come to a story with a particular perspective. You know, I am a middle-aged white guy with young kids and a personal history, all of which affect how I do my job, but if I do it well enough, then someone's going to look at it and say, I've come away with all of the information in order to know what I need to know about this.
I'd add to that that a mark of good journalism is being willing to be persuaded by fact, yes, even if you didn't start out that way, or even if 5 years from now there's a bunch of facts that come to light that change. And that is the mark of doing a journalist's job, is realizing that there's always more fact. There's always more that we can probably gather and better understand.
You're talking about individual stories. If Chad Livengood, when he was covering Lansing, does 15 stories about legislation that Republicans introduced, whether it's good or bad, but he's just doing those stories, and he does two about legislation that Democrats introduced, is that bias?
Absolutely. Then? We're always doing that as journalists. We're always trying to figure out what it is that you want to know. I mean, we don't waste our time on stories that nobody's going to read. I mean, you know, there are those times where you think this is the greatest story in the world and nobody reads it. Okay, you messed up. But we're always trying to pick the stories that we think people are interested in. So to speak to her point, is there bias in the story selection? Yes, we're trying to select the stories that people want to know about, the subjects and the issues that people are most concerned about. Are there journalism outlets, quote unquote, that only pick certain types of stories? Fox News? Yes. But, I mean, you know, in the purest form, journalists, we're looking for the information that people have the right to know, that people want to know. And there is bias in story selection. You're picking one story over the other.
It's the point.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Hands. Yeah. Lindsay, we've got one in the way back there. Oh, just a second. Lindsay, I'll get there.
Yeah. My name is Tony, and I come from the village of Ann Arbor. And my question is...
36 square miles surrounded by reality.
By reality. You got that. Is the whole issue of equivalency. There's a lot of... as now the phrase is coming to be, alternative facts. Mm-hmm. So you've got two versions of a story. Potentially, there's the issue of, well, we have to show both sides. When you know damn well that the alternative facts are flat-out lies, how do you deal with that in terms of your responsibility to the public?
We start out by not calling them alternative facts.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, there's another word for it, which is crude.
Yeah. So, Chad, you're at a protest, and there's 50 people there, and you talk to a spokesperson who says, well, no, there were 500. There were 500 people there, Chad. You just didn't count right. What do you do?
You simply state in the story. A reporter counted 50 people, and then quote, there were 400 people here, you have to just lay out in the story, in the content.
But you have now become untrustworthy. Your story now is, well, we don't believe Chad.
No, I think what Tony is alluding to and what Chad is touching on is sort of the challenge of the age that we're within, that it used to be that by and large, not entirely, but people who violated this norm could be easily ignored, that when you went to someone and said, how many people were at your rally, and they told you 500, but it was really 400, but you knew that they were sort of in within what I would call the ballpark of accuracy, right, and that you could, by and large, trust the sources that you're dealing with. In the era of alternative facts, which is another way of saying alternative realities, then it becomes different, and it becomes more incumbent upon us to go out and do even more fact-checking to make sure that what we're doing is presenting a realistic view of whatever it is that we're talking about, that in fact it is a real view and not just the old-fashioned, well, so-and-so disputed, how many people were at the rally. I mean, what we've got to do is we've got to become, I think, a bit more ballsy and courageous about sharing what we see with our own eyes and what we uncover.
You're lying with our eyes.
Well, we also.
You're lying eyes.
We as journalists, we just need to get out of crowd estimates in general, out of the business.
Stopped doing this a long time ago.
I learned this lesson one time. I covered a Sarah Palin rally in the Bass Pro parking lot in Springfield, Missouri.
Oh, Lord.
In like October 2008,
Chad is better than all of
us. I tweeted the whole thing on a BlackBerry, and
Someone
told me, one of the organizers said, yeah, they got like 2,000 people. Someone from Bass Pro, like one of the guys made 2,000 people.
So, and I once caught a fish.
So I put that in the story. And I just got endless calls and emails and hate mail. There was 10,000 people there, like a week later, Barack Obama came to town and held a rally in a football stadium, high school football stadium. And there were people 4 or 5 miles in line for that thing. It was verifiable by driving down the road and clocking it, which
but
we had a reporter do.
But one of the things I've learned from covering these
is part of what's going on then is that what we're now seeing is journalists having to work harder to fact check verifiable facts, and it's the dangly thing over here, and so we're spending all of our time just trying to say no, the sky is blue,
and we're not
green.
Covering the words coming out of people's mouths.
Yeah. But
we get caught up in just that, which is that I know from covering rallies at the state capitol that the state capitol managers have a particular method where they estimate crowd size, and police agencies do the same thing when they're managing crowds and things like that. And our norm has kind of been just to go to the authority and be, this is what so-and-so says. Like you said, you source it, but we sort of treat it as gospel. And we're not really questioning the method, which is why we no longer, like you said, we no longer say, a crowd estimated at blah, 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 unless there's a certain number of numbered seats that we can count, that we just say several hundred, several thousand.
I mean, all you can do is attribute it. I didn't make it up. I didn't count the people. This is what, the Park Service said. This is what the president said. I mean, all you can do is source.
I have counted so many heads in little small crowds.
Oh, yeah. Well, at a school board meeting, 1, 2,
but
three,
I'd like to move us off a little bit about this, which I think is actually in some ways a little bit trivial because journalists don't do it so much anymore. But your question was not... Okay, your question was, if you've got 500 people over here who say this thing and one person over here who says that thing, How do we as journalists write a story that lets you know that there are 500 people over here who say this and only 100 people over here who say that, or one person? My favorite illustration of this is, believe it or not, John Stewart, who did a wonderful story about climate change, where he had about 100 scientists in lab coats, because it's TV, right, and it's comedy, come out and say, this is what we think. And then he had the one guy over here. We call this weight of evidence, and it's really difficult journalistically to figure out how to phrase that and how to frame that in a way that readers and viewers won't understand. It's not that people don't understand it. It's that they understand instead how deep the factual basis of something is and how off the wall, if you will, something else over here is not.
That the binary argument can be so misleading.
Well, and it gets back to what you say. It's not just as you said as well, it's not just black or white, or it's not just he said, she said, which is probably among this group of people my least favorite kind of journalism to do.
Yeah.
Because it feels like stenography. And I didn't go to journalism school to learn how to do that.
But there's a certain amount that we have to do, because we have to prove and constantly prove to people that we are disaffected observers. We are just like the fly on the wall. How many times have we said that? The fly on the wall. We are disaffected observers. I don't have a dog in the race. I don't have a kid in the school. It's just I'm observing. I observe and report. And so we have to do a lot of the he said, she said, so that people don't think that I said it, you know?
Well, no, I think you're right. But I also think that there are some things, I think you put it really well. You know, I'm a Caucasian 67-year-old grandmother. I bring that to my journalism. You can like that, you cannot like that, but that is who I am. So I have to develop a way to let you know that even though I have that life experience and I come knowing or thinking those things, that I've still gone out there and looked for things that did not agree, that were not my life experience, and that I've tried to share them with you in a legitimate, forthright, as truthful manner as I can get at.
Okay, let's go to the next question. Yeah, yeah, right here. Lindsay, where is Lindsay? Oh, sorry, I'm making you run.
She's getting her exercise.
I know, she is. She is. Yeah, yeah.
Be nice.
Me? I'm Lisa from Ann Arbor. My question is more about what level of protection do journalists actually have today in the climate of so many attacks against truth and even languaging with this concept that if anyone raises an issue of that could be considered criticism to the administration, then they are attacking the administration. I have huge concerns about protection for journalists and truth, and how I want to know what you think about that.
Do you have a family member that's a journalist?
I'm Zoe's mom. Truth and transparency.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to throw this one actually to Rick, because you were at one of the initial Trump rallies in Michigan, where he did one of the first, like, real times. It was CNN Live. And he did the thing where he was like, let's turn the cameras on the journalists.
In Grand Rapids.
Yeah, you were on the podium too. So, you know, you've got a crowd that you're supposed to be writing the story about. And instead, you know, Trump is going, where are those guys?
President Trump did something.
And you said to me that was the first time that you've actually felt somewhat...
threatened.
Yeah, threatened.
And you know, that was the intent, although I felt worse for the people with TV cameras. What President Trump would do before he was president in the campaign was he would rile the crowd by saying, they've got this camera pointed up here, and they don't want the public to see how many people have filled this stadium. They don't want them to see that. So tell them to turn it around, and he would get the crowd to chant, turn the camera, turn the camera, turn the camera. Now, because he's a seasoned, I don't know the man, I've never spoken with him, but anyone who knows anything about television and coverage knows this is being recorded. Oh, well, that's bullshit. That television news organizations do is they have two cameras there. And one is trained always on the podium and on the candidate who's speaking, because you don't want to miss a moment of that because you don't know what's going on. And there's a second camera and sometimes a third and maybe even a fourth that's going out and getting pictures of the crowd. And any television report about a campaign rally would always include that. And from my very, very, very limited experience in television, I do know that one of the aspects of it, is there anyone here who has experience in television journalism? Oh, yeah, Matt up front. That so much, back me up here, so much of television journalism is the constant, insatiable, relentless search for B-roll. Those cutaway shots where you go back and forth. So they were doing both. And as near as I could tell, that was basically an intentional falsehood that targeted not just journalists, but a couple of journalists in particular.
Katie Turr from NBC actually has gotten direct tweets and actually folks outside of her home in Washington, D.C. How many people have actually talked to Donald Trump just one-on-one before? Hands? I'm talking the panel too there. So Chad, you were at this same event. You then interviewed Donald Trump. Let's pull the curtain back a little bit. Maybe this isn't so much attacking, but I think it's an interesting anecdote for folks who have met Donald Trump in large rallies and also had one-on-one conversations. And often what we hear is, in front of the rallies, he's hyperbolic. He is, yep, Donald Trump. And then you're in a room with him one-on-one, and he's kind of low-key, actually. And
yeah,
somewhat
pretty quiet and a little meek, actually. Yeah, I was at this rally
twice, right?
Yeah, once in Toledo and once here in Detroit. Just at this rally, this is the one where he had just gotten called out by Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe about nuzzling up to Putin. And Scarborough said, yeah, but Donald...
it was the same rally where he said that he would maybe... I would never kill a jerk.
Yeah, he went on for like a minute. I would never kill you. And he just kept saying it. It was like, you know, kind of Dr. Evil sounding. It was a little intense because the people were looking at, I mean, everybody in the entire stadium was looking at the press pen. And but yeah, he had just had this back and forth, and he was reenacting the whole thing. That's how he got into it. He also said some other sort of very vulgar things about Hillary Clinton too that night too. So
right.
A lot of headlines came out of that one. But yeah, Donald Trump in person.
And he actually also made a policy pronouncement about the autos that
Oh yeah, he made it clear he was going to kick Ford six ways from Sunday, I believe.
But I think what I'm getting at is it's an act of acting like, you know, you have the enemy in the press, and yet then one-on-one, it's
right,
quite affable.
Yeah, I mean, in my first interview with him, that was the day that he had the press conference in Florida where he had encouraged Russia to find Hillary Clinton's missing 35,000 emails. And then by the end of the day, I'm interviewing him at 8 p.m. in Toledo in a back room in a hockey arena. And I asked him about it. Were you really serious? No, we were just kidding around. And he's like, next question. And I was like, well, no, you seemed like you're really serious about it. We were all having fun, you know, and he moves on. So this is the kind of game you got to deal with. I mean, he's not the only politician who's ever kind of not answered questions. I mean, this is what we have to deal with. And we have to essentially just lay it out. You know, Trump sidestepped questions. I use the word sidestep all the time. About every three stories of Rick Snyder is the word sidestep.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about it. Remember the press conference that he had where he dismissed the first one he had as president? He dismissed the CNN reporter because, you know, you're just fake news. RTNDA passed a resolution condemning it and you know, all kinds of people like, why didn't the other journalists, you know,
so tough RTNDA.
Yeah, I know. It's like, grow up. You know, that if you've ever sat in a press conference like that or been in a scrum, that you know that sometimes politicians will zero in on a particular reporter.
So is the issue then that journalists are sitting ducks? Because as we take the attacks, if any one of us step up and start to fight back, then we are showing our bias.
Never fight back. I fight back with my next story. You don't fight back. You don't engage. You know, you cover the engagement, but you don't engage, at least from the news reporter side. Commentary, please. I love Charles Blow. Go for it, you know. But I, as a journalist, you know, I don't engage.
Right. And
so I want to get. I want to get back to your question because it's very serious to me. According to the committee for the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, since 1992, more than 1,100 journalists have died bringing you and me the news. We're really lucky. We live in a place where that doesn't tend to happen. But I tell you true, I've had students in harm's way. I mean, really serious harm's way, as in the UN had taken everybody else out and they were still there. So this notion that we don't live in a dangerous profession, that people don't give their lives for this thing called the First Amendment, I remember that every morning when I get up and when I go into the classroom, because it really is serious in that way.
And don't forget, Investigative Reporters and Editors was started because a journalist was assassinated in Arizona.
And governments do target journalists. I mean, I don't know that the American government does, but certainly the Russian government has, and I mean, many, many, many. So I take your question very seriously. And I think that even though we are not in physical danger, at least I don't feel that way most of the time, there are psychological attacks. There are all of these sorts of things that journalists are subjected to and have been historically subjected to. But whether or not it's gotten more intense now, I'm not a working journalist right at this moment. I can't say. But it is to say this is something I talk with my students about. It's something all of us talk with our students about. The second thing I want to say in response to you is I think one of the ways that we're going to have to change journalistically is we're going to have to decide how much solidarity we have as a profession and how much we want to compete against one another, or whether there is some virtue some of the time in working collaboratively.
But we do that already. That in
yes,
situations like that, and I've been in I can't count how many over 30 years, situations where a candidate, an elected official, targets a particular reporter during a scrum. And then everyone, you know, right there in real time has to make the decision, what am I going to do about this?
Step up right now.
Well, and it's, well, do I have another line of inquiry that's more important than this particular challenge? Sometimes you do. But sometimes, too, someone goes, I mean, they don't go, hey, stop picking on him because, you know, we're big. We can handle it. But you can go, but back to this question. Let's go to
well, I think
and,
what
and
happens
that, and that definitely happens
blood.
A lot.
You start smelling blood and reporters start realizing because you're in a scrum, which is basically when there's a politician and a bunch of reporters are around. And that politician's handlers start trying to grab the politician and take him away, and the politician keeps talking.
Well, that's a slightly different situation.
Questions. Yeah.
Once that starts to happen, then that is when the handler pulls them away. Yeah. Thank you very much, Governor. Thank you very much, Senator. Yeah. Thank you very much, Representative.
But you know what, Lisa, to answer your question, there are organizations, associations, unions that are so you know supposed to stick up for us, and they do. But, I mean, we don't walk out the door with any guarantees. I covered 9/11, and I was in danger. You know, I've covered those crazy-ass weather situations in mountains where I was in danger. But there's no guarantees.
Well, what was that T-shirt on Facebook that was going around in a lot of journalists?
Absolutely.
The rope tree journalists.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, have I gotten death threats on the phone by email? Yes. There's no guarantees. But, you know, somebody's got to do it.
Okay, let's go to some more questions. Yeah. Sure, right here. Yeah, right here. Yeah. And I can tell you, I don't think that just necessarily happens with any hard stories. I was on the phone last week with a listener who told me that I should go back to being a social worker if I was a woman in journalism. So let's just say that it happens no matter what. Yeah.
So my name's Ann, and I'm from Farmington.
Hi, Ann.
Metro Detroit. And something that occurs to me as I both read and listen is I think what you cover is different now than what it used to be. And I want you to even go harder at that, because I think the news isn't just what's happening in front of you. It's everything. There's a fuller context now, just like everything you're talking about, the risks involved, the number of attendees, 200 versus 500, and who's saying that? And just, I mean, there's a lot more richness, I think, that's in that part of it. That's not just a reporting about what's happening in front of you. So that's kind of, does that ring true at all, or am I off base?
Yeah, no, I think you are. I think the first thing, and maybe it didn't come to everyone on this stage, but since I've become program director, which means that I manage a budget of 32 different programming and newsroom staff, I think all of us wish that at any single moment we could be in every single city in Michigan, and we could be having an enterprise unit and an investigative unit, and that I could have four different people in Flint today right now talking to folks. And for me, at least, it's a bottom line, and it's about money. I think every single one of us wakes up on this stage hoping to dig deeper and do exactly what you're saying. But when you've only got so much staff and so much personnel to be able to do that, and I would like to start talking a little bit about, you know, what that means for Michigan going forward and the state of journalism, which we can, or maybe, you know, questions we'll get to that. But
I think this is an amazing
I got a question for Chastity, actually. Maybe you can kind of explain your recent story on the pneumonia outbreak, or the spike in numbers, and how kind of explain how you found that story. I imagine that took days, weeks, months.
It took months. So January of 2016 is when the governor said to everyone, oh, there's this thing called Legionnaires that's been happening in Flint, right? So, and then we find out that the state knew since March, and the county knew for more than a year that there had been a Legionnaires outbreak during the height of the water crisis. And so my story, I mean, I didn't go to journalism school, but I was trained, you know, the old school way. And so I said, okay, let's see. If there are people dying of Legionnaires, then I'm sure there are lawyers out there who are representing people who have died. And I started just calling people who are lawyers, trying to find out, well, what happened to your family or your dead person or what happened. And then I was led to a family in Flint who was being represented by a civil rights lawyer. But their thing was, we don't know if she had Legionnaires. We think she might have, but we know she had pneumonia. And so the reporter in me was like, so what does that have to do with anything? And I really just started looking for data. Okay, so pneumonia Legionnaires is a form of pneumonia. We know that there was this Legionnaires outbreak, but what happened with pneumonia? It took me months to get the state to tell us how many people died from pneumonia during that time that people were dying from Legionnaires. Months. And they still haven't told us everything that we wanted to know. So it started as just like old school shoe leather reporting, literally getting on the phone, calling, finding out who died from Legionnaires. And then the story from one lawyer came that, well, you know, it's not just Legionnaires, it's pneumonia. And so the story that Chad is talking about ran a couple weeks ago, and what we found is that during the 2 years that the state essentially knew that Legionnaires was happening and didn't tell anyone, there was also an outbreak of people dying from pneumonia that people didn't talk about, didn't investigate. The state still doesn't know whether those people also had Legionnaires. They never tested them.
Quick question. How did you know which lawyers to call?
Stories. Stories that, I mean, you know, Figer and, I mean,
So you started with the big one?
I started with the big ones. And, I mean, and then I just started calling people in Flint. I'd spent a couple days in Flint talking to people in the community. Do you know anybody who died from this? Do you know anybody? And, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, just being around and people seeing you and trusting you and talking to you. And eventually one lawyer was like, yeah, well, I know somebody who knows somebody. And I got around to Attorney Goodman, who's a civil rights lawyer here in Detroit, and it turned out that he was representing a family who, they were really famous in Flint. Actually, they're like NBA players throughout this entire family, and this woman had died from pneumonia, and that it was incredible that she was supposed to be tested for Legionnaires, but they didn't test her, so they essentially just said, well, it must be pneumonia. But they never really knew. And there were so many other just word-of-mouth stories in Flint like that. My mom died from Legionnaires. I mean, from pneumonia. The number of people who died from pneumonia almost doubled, but nobody could explain why. And they couldn't call it Legionnaires or not call it Legionnaires because, hey, they didn't test them.
I want to jump in about something, though, that I've heard both of you say. So, Chad, you were with Tim Ward, I'm assuming was the ferry boat driver, again, you know, the Detroit River. And Chastity, you got to spend days, you know, in Flint. That's not, I mean, that is the minority of time, I would say, that journalists right now get to spend. And I say get to, because that's what most journalists would love to be doing is going out in the field and covering that. But let's go back, and a lot of these smaller town papers that don't have Bridge Magazine or Cranes, or I'll say Michigan Radio, are taking the press releases. And isn't that part of the problem, that you have the ability, because of money and your organization, and you do as well, to have that time? And a lot of news organizations in Michigan simply don't right now.
And I'm going to be real quick, but the way that we end up writing a story about 200 people dying from pneumonia, the way that you get a Bridge Magazine is the fact that when I started at the Free Press in 2001, between the Free Press and the news, there were 600 people in the newsroom. After these last layoffs and buyouts, between the two papers, there's 160 journalists. So it's what, a sliver, a quarter of what it used to be. So of course you can't do what you used to do. So of course the Center for Michigan starts Bridge Magazine and essentially goes shopping at the Free Press and the News for reporters. Everyone at Bridge Magazine either worked at the Free Press or the News, except for one person. She worked at Fort Wayne. So, I mean, because the bigger papers don't have the staff to do what they used to do, what we love doing so much, the investigative stuff, you have, you know, Bridge Magazine, you have ProPublica, you have all these new media coming up to fill in the gaps. And then now I get to spend 2 days in Flint and tell you that 200 people died from pneumonia and they probably actually had Legionnaires.
You know, and there is a future in not-for-profit journalism and not-for-profit and for-profit partnerships. But there is one thing, and this is an amazing time to be a journalist, especially at that, but there is one a conundrum that we have not resolved, which is that the journalism ecosystem has changed profoundly in that it used to be that there was a way that stories sort of filtered up to the top, and that there would be a local weekly newspaper that sat in the city council meetings and the boards of education and the planning commissions and all of that, and they published really boring, not particularly well-written stories about it, alongside, you know, publishing verbatim press releases from local elected officials and businesses and community colleges, you know, once a week. And it was someone's job at the Free Press and the News and the wherever to actually read those, because that was part of their regional beat, and they would occasionally find a story out of that. And by the way, that's also how, you know, very local talent was identified. And sometimes the local radio station would pick it up as well. As a matter of fact, as a former newspaper reporter, I will tell you that I know the anguish of hearing Chad's nodding his head, of hearing something on the radio that's like, yeah, uh-huh, I know where that came from. Yeah. But it worked its way up until the big regional newspaper, and then sometimes the big national paper found it. And we really haven't found a replacement for the bottom of that ecosystem, where people are grifting for good stories in the places where you don't have someone at the big city school board or even the medium city city council looking for all of that stuff. And I'm talking to someone who, you know, I'm a former newspaper stringer from New Jersey who owes my career to the Springfield Township Board of Education. And I will tell that story sometime if anyone wants to hear it over a beer. I won't do it now, you know, but that matters.
Well, on that uplifting note about the future of journalism, let's go to a few more questions. Yeah, let's see. Lindsay?
Sure.
Yep.
Hi, I'm Nate. I live in Detroit.
Hi, Nate.
I'm a grad student at Wayne State, and I also teach there. I've had countless journalism students in my class, and they complain over and over and over again
about Jack Lessenberry.
Sure. about how they've done unpaid internship after unpaid internship after unpaid internship. And repeatedly they read stories about how journalism is one of the most economically unstable careers that you can go into as a young person, especially with college debt, especially with the decline of J schools, and especially with the fact that people are not paying for content anymore. I don't pay for any of my news, and I know that makes me a bad citizen, but I'm also
get
poor.
Out. You're dead to us.
What's your address again?
I'm also poor and in grad school, and so I just don't have the income. How do we make this economically sustainable for people who want to go into the career? Because right now it's not. And how do we make people who maybe have more money than I do to actually pay for good content? Because I think that's a major problem right now. When New York Times has to partner up with Spotify to convince young people to pay for a subscription, that's a huge problem.
And I want Chad Livengood to answer that, but here's a question, just because I think other than, you know, Bridge right now in Michigan, in terms of, you know, non-for-profit journalism, where basically we work on the honor system, and Michigan Radio is one of them. So just a check of hands, because I always find this fascinating, and I have a group of people here. So how many of you, and I want to talk about how many people who listen to Michigan Radio, and there is a percentage of people who listen who you think then give to Michigan Radio. So if 100% of the people who listen, raise your hands if you think it's 75% or more of the people who listen give to Michigan Radio. Okay, what about 50% or more? Okay. So how about 75% of the you know, 25% who listen give? Okay, so 1 in 4. How about 1 in 10? Yeah. You want to know the actual number? Yeah, you know from Fund Drive, 6%. Freeloader. No. Well, okay, maybe a little bit. But no. As program director, I would never call them a freeloader. But what I'm saying is 6%.
However.
6% of the people who listen to Michigan Radio give. If we could boost that to 10, think about the things that you know, the Flint coverage that we did last year, to 10. Or, gosh forbid, double to 12% of the people who listen.
But it's our culture, is that we're used to broadcasting over the airwaves, that we don't pay anything more except for the time that we spend listening to advertising. That when... You know, and the same being true for TV and with newspapers, that we would spend. I remember when newspapers hit 50 cents, and people were like, God, you know, people do that. You know, and that people used to spend 35 cents a day. And
paper that was this thick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I want to go to Chad on this because, A, you love talking about sort of the business of journalism, but, B, one of the things I love that Chad will do is, like, on Instagram and Facebook, he'll take a photo of the Sunday paper and sort of do a, like, hey, for $1.50, here's everything.
Here's what you get.
For $2, here's everything you're getting.
Yeah, I've been a shameless supporter of newspapers for a long time.
Do it, man. Do it. We all need to be.
Have multiple subscriptions. You know, I think you just, we have to somehow get back to, we value information. And we made, as an industry, one of the most colossal financial mistakes of the 20th century in giving away our product for free in the mid-90s and assuming that, like, it would never go anywhere.
You can't put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah,
right?
It's impossible to reconstruct this whole thing. And so with that, we have to, these other models, they're starting to work. Who has a Washington Post online subscription? I'm a big fan. It was the first time I signed up for $19.99, and then the next year, like, you got to renew for $39.99, and then last year, it was like, well, you got to renew for $129.99.
But look at that. There was like two hands, but how many people pay $10 a month for Netflix?
Yeah,
and that's pay over $60 a month.
Who pays like $5 a month for like caller ID on your phone? I mean, come on. I mean, so.
But I guess I would turn it back on you. You know, who asked the question, which is, well, how much do you value it? I mean, okay, you're poor, but you're here having a beer.
Because it's...
Don't make him choose between a pint and...
But is it 35 cents a day? I mean, that's what people used to pay for a newspaper. Is it 50 cents a day?
But it goes back to what Chad said.
Sorry?
Because you believe in it. Why pay for it if it's free? That's the problem. Like Chad said, the problem was in the 90s, they started giving it away for free, and now they got to charge for it because they can't get
print advertising. And the problem in a lot of metropolitan markets, especially Detroit, the Detroit News and Free Press cannot put a paywall up. If you go in the other Gannett, every other small market Gannett paper, Battle Creek, Port Huron, Lansing, they all have paywalls. All their community have to pay for their information, and everyone here gets to write for free. And because of that, the reason is that you got three television stations that are highly competitive, and it's all about clicks and a headline for like a quick five-graph story on the fire on the east side right now. And that's the reality that we face.
And it's a conundrum. How many people hit their 10 article a month limit on the New York Times? What do you do when you do that? Wait, what do you do? Hold on, wait. What do you do? And I'll just repeat your answer.
Yeah.
What do you do? You open an incognito browser, you move to another device. Yeah. There are just so many ways around it. Is that
our
industry has not figured out how to get around, you know, that we want to give people a taste of it, a sense of what it is. We haven't figured out how exactly to get you to go, okay, you know, now I have no more choice. I want it. I have no place else to go. Now I gots to pay for it.
I want to push back just a little bit harder. I get this question a lot from my students, the journalism students, and I don't have an answer because it's one of the things that has happened is our profession has become hollowed out.
If there's anything more confusing than politics, it's economics.
But let me say, a reliance on free information may have given us the election that we all deserved in 2016.
Yeah.
And you may not like hearing that, but it is a question that I carry with me. Because, of course, if you get it for free, you may not value it, but what's worse is you may not analyze it. And so we get to have clickbait from the Ukraine because people aren't literate enough to know that that is fake news, and after all, it just all comes for free anyway. So I think we do pay a price, and I think that price, I would rather get it out of my wallet than to pay it politically. And yes, that tells everybody in the room, I think, something about my own political beliefs, but I would be saying this regardless, and did say it actually for a couple of presidents before the gentleman we just elected. So, you know, this is something that I want to, I mean, your question is the right one. How much do you value it? Do you value it enough to become better informed so that you're a better voter? Do you value it enough to become better informed so that you're a better teacher, a better parent, a better neighbor? Those things don't come to us for free, even in a democratic society. Okay, enough lecturing.
Yeah, and one last point. As an industry, we have to get our act together when it comes to talent and development because we are driving a lot of people away with unpaid internships, which I think ought to be illegal to begin with. And public relations department does it too, or public relations agencies do it. And then the other thing is I'm 12 years out of college now, and I am one out of eight of my classmates, I'm the last guy still in the business. They're all going to public relations, yeah. and I changed jobs just now, and most people would have put a bet that I was going to public relations too. But I'm in for the fight still. But there aren't a lot of people who are in for the fight because they're getting dispirited, or it is dragging. I've been in daily newspapers where every year has been involving a cut, and so we as an industry have to find a way to get out of that for the sake of our own talent, because I've seen a lot of really good journalists bolt to the to the higher paychecks or the more reliable paychecks.
I think the question is so central to what's the future of journalism. I mean, there's only so much advertising money to go around, and the advertisers are dumping it on the internet and websites and not so much with the print product, which is why the print product is shrinking, which is why it only comes in Detroit to your house 3 days a week, and it's actually smaller actual physical newspaper than it was when we grew up. It was way bigger, not anymore, because there's only so much advertising money to go around, and when you have to compete with all these online, with the online presence, then of course newsrooms are going to shrink, especially when you have for-profit newspapers, the Free Press and the News, and shareholders to answer to. With Bridge, we don't have shareholders to answer to. We're not-for-profit, and we are also trying to figure out ways to diversify our revenue stream, because Phil Power is not going to always give us all his money every year. And so now we're partnering with Cranes, and that's how you're getting your Bridge, through Cranes and not through M Live anymore. Or, you know, we're selling it to the smaller papers for, you know, a small fee, but we have to diversify so that we can continue to hire folks. We just hired an editor, and we're hoping to hire another reporter, because we're filling in where the other newspapers are no longer able to give you news.
And I would say, Chastity, too, that that's a really interesting dynamic when you're talking about, you know, nonprofit and for-profit, that right now I think Bridge and Michigan Radio, you know, we just hired two new folks who are going to work on news gathering within the past year. Where else is that happening? But it's happening because folks like you who are out tonight have stepped up, even with that 6%. So we've got about 4 more minutes.
Although,
so
let's, I will say, really quick questions.
Chastity
said something really, really important.
Okay.
They hired an editor. Not an on-the-ground reporter, an editor. Someone who's
editors still matter.
Yeah,
very
yeah.
much so.
Yeah.
And
we hired a player coach, though.
Okay, let's do a couple. Yeah, Lindsay. Yes, right back there, all the way back. Yep.
Real quick, the right-wing radio personality Charlie Sykes published an editorial in the New York Times yesterday, where he was lamenting his role in right. Destroying the credibility of the press. Any comment?
I read it. It was interesting.
Don't engage. Maybe they'll go away.
Well, but you are seeing this. I mean, now you've got Glenn Beck, who for, you know, the mid-aughts was sort of on the forefront of that. Remember him kind of like fake crying or real crying or whatever that crying was on Fox News about Obama. Now you have him going, wait, maybe we went too far. The piece was how, you know, Republican media or conservative media is basically going to give cover to Trump. And it's an interesting read. Yeah, let's try to get through a couple more questions. Yeah, Lindsay, there's one back there. Yep.
Hi, I'm Jordan. I'm from Ann Arbor. So my question here is, we talked a little bit about paywalls and the idea of, you know, journalism not being able to pay for itself. But my question is journalism falling behind as far as technology and being savvy and kind of like taking advantage of all of the resources that are out there? I mean, print media, don't get me wrong, print media is beautiful and it's wonderful, but is print media the future? And then also, are there other avenues that aren't being pursued simply because we're unwilling to move away from what we have already done? We say you can't put up a paywall because it was free before, but if everyone puts up a paywall, what choice do we have but to pay?
Get everyone to agree.
Yeah.
So let me correct one thing. Journalism has never been profitable. The issue was you paid when you washed by advertising, not when you watched. So in essence, what's happening is that our advertising revenues are what are leaving us. But the notion that people have ever gotten rich doing journalism, please point me there. I'd like
Amen.
Even one instance.
We get paid in tote bags, actually, at Michigan Radio.
I don't even have that.
I'm just lamenting the fact that we don't have interns anymore. I was an intern, and if not for internships, I wouldn't be a journalist because I didn't go to J school. So now you go to the Free Press, the News, they're like, where are they? They're not there anymore.
Oh, interns are so amazingly important. Yeah.
Yeah. Although I would also be careful about two things. One, when you say print journalism as though that's the only journalism. I mean, yeah.
Well, all journalism is now print journalism. And online. Online journalism.
It comes on this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. But I would also say when you're talking about, you know, are we falling behind? I mean, Serial, right? That was a podcast. I would argue that it was part journalism, at least, and it was, you know, the number one most listened to podcast there for a while, produced by public radio. I would consider that some kind of journalism, and I think it was at the forefront of telling stories in a way that we really hadn't seen 5 years ago, even.
Have you noticed that the New York Times now does a daily radio podcast of the news, and it's like they're a print product. Why are they reading the news? Why do they have some guy whose voice you can listen to?
Well, because the idea that there are print journalists and broadcast journalists and video journalists and audio journalists
is getting
an anachronism.
It's getting blurry, right? Yeah. I mean, they get
no, it's not blurry. It's gone.
They gave me one of these and said, take pictures. And I said, I'm in a union. They got somebody for that. We got people. But apparently I have to take pictures now. And
well, now, that's,
other
that's
stuff.
A different problem. The
Which we will get to in another Issues and Ale. And we have one more question left. So, Lindsay, choose wisely. It's all up to you. I'm not taking that, that responsibility. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Pete. I'm from Royal Oak, 59-year-old grandfather.
Hi, Pete.
But my main question for tonight that I haven't heard addressed yet is I keep hearing about how they want to, you know, censor Facebook to flush out the fake news. You know, if Facebook does it, is the Free Press going to do it? Is Bridge going to do it? Is Michigan Public Radio going to do it? Where do you guys see the future of, like, trying to regulate the news that people are getting?
Does anyone want to take that?
It's a really tough question because we live in this country that has this thing called the First Amendment. You may have heard of it. So we're... As a country, we're really reluctant to do that. You go to Britain, okay, different country, same language. They don't have the same point of view that we do. I will say that I'm really, really ticked at Mark Zuckerberg for his wimpy approach to fake news, because what he did, because he didn't want to ruin his business model, is he said, oh, well, we'll just get all the Facebook users to note that this is fake news, because he doesn't want to hire an editor. Because if he were to hire an editor, he'd become legally liable. So, I mean, you want to get mad or get even, actually, don't get mad, get even, you know, tell Facebook to get a grip.
And I think this goes back to the initial conversation about, you know, whose ability is it? Who you know, is meant to be the one doing it? Is it the news organizations? Is it Facebook? Or is it the consumers who are meant to spend an extra minute, an extra 30 seconds doing your due diligence to see, you know, where is your information coming from? And I see Steve Krupinski walking up the steps, which means our time is done. My guess is most of the folks here on the panel will be more than happy to stick around, mostly because Michigan Radio is buying their beer. To answer some questions. If you've got some more afterwards, we'd love to continue to chat. As you can tell, we could talk about this all night long and into the early morning hours. I'm not buying beer until the early morning hours. But if folks do want to talk a little bit more, we'll be up here. And thank you so much for coming out. I think it's a pretty amazing thing that we'd get a crowd like this to talk about the future of you know, something that we all find really important, but I think that we all interact with on a daily basis and maybe don't quite give it the attention that it deserves. So thank you, everyone, and thanks for the great questions. Steve.
Thank you for being part of the crowd of 3,000 people here this evening. But who's counting? So thanks again for coming. A big round of applause for Hopcat. Make sure you tip your wait staff. They've been doing a great job tonight. And we want to thank our panel for joining us tonight. And we do have more information. We didn't touch on this on the.
Can I just do a quick thing?
You talked about internship. Michigan Radio actually just within the last year, started paying all of our interns in our newsroom.
And that's actually because of you folks, and it's a huge deal. And we've gotten some of the most amazing, amazing interns. In fact, Lindsay Scullin, who was taking questions, started as an intern, gosh, Lindsay, almost 2 years ago, and got hired for a job. So for folks who say there aren't journalism jobs out there, I started as an intern a million years ago. I will actually do a plug very quickly, which is this, that if you do believe in journalism that is important, that is getting to the topics, I would say do what you can to support Cranes, do what you can to support Bridge Magazine, and of course, Michigan Radio, 888-258-9866. MichiganRadio.org. We have fleeces. The tote bags of which we get paid in. But really, you know, and we were giving you a hard time about, well, if you can buy a beer. But seriously, if you can, if $5 does actually really make a difference, it actually really does. So thank you, everyone, so much, and thanks for letting me get on the soapbox for a second about that. Okay.